TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Super Patriotism and the Importance of Being Number One. What does it mean to love one's country? Why is it important to be number one? In this sharp and funny speech, Michael Parenti dissects the uses of patriotism. That was the introduction to a Michael Parenti talk given in 1988 at the end of the Reagan administration. That talk became a TUC radio program and 2004 book published by City Lights. Super Patriotism: How Hype, Fear, and Mindless Flag Waving Are Supplanting Informed Debate and Commitment to Democracy. Now, so many years later, slogans such as America First, America the Greatest Country on Earth, are having a powerful comeback. Resistance to super patriotism, even if it is simply remaining seated during the national anthem at a sports event, can draw a hateful response from those who Parenti was concerned about a generation ago. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale. He's the author of 23 books and many more articles. His works have been translated into 18 languages. He grew up in an Italian-American working-class family in New York City. His PhD from Yale would have guaranteed him a career in academia. He knowingly gave up that chance when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam and was arrested. He decided to become an independent author, lecturer, and activist. Here's Michael Parenti in 1988 in Boulder, Colorado, recorded by KGNU Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a very special pleasure to be here in the Boulder political community. The title of the talk is Super Patriotism, Real Patriotism, and the Importance of Being Number One. Well, as a guest on radio talk shows, I have on a number of occasions criticized U.S. foreign policy, and one time an irate caller called in and he said to me, do you love your country? And the question was obviously rhetorical. Here was someone who saw fit to question my patriotism because I was questioning the policies of our leaders. The caller was manifesting a symptom of what might be called super patriotism, also sometimes called stupor patriotism, also called pseudo-patriotism, a phenomenon best defined as the willingness to follow our leaders uncritically in all their dealings with other nations, especially when those dealings are confrontational and belligerent and they involve a question of national pride or the use of military force. That's the definition of super patriotism. This super patriotism or American chauvinism has been with us throughout much of our history, and whether or not it's the last refuge of scoundrels, as Dr. Johnson would say, it certainly is a very effective instrument in discouraging and discrediting critical public discourse. Well, I think it's time that the super patriots account for their brand of patriotism and explain to us what it's all about. For instance, what do they mean when they say they love their country? What do they mean by country? You know, academia is not totally without certain virtues. You learn to ask a lot of trivial, detailed questions in any case. So I asked myself, what do you mean by country? Do they love every region and locale in the United States? Well, obviously, very few of us have been to every region and locale. Does love of country mean loving the American people? Well, again, even the most gregarious among us have met only a relatively small portion of the American people. And I would bet that these super patriots don't particularly love whole sectors of the American public, especially the more bigoted super patriots. In fact, rather dislike to associate with or have any positive identification with certain people because of reasons of ethnicity, religion, race, and class. Do super patriots love America for its history and culture? Again, I'm really skeptical of that because it's my impression that they know very little about American history and culture, or rather, much of it is rather unappreciated by them. Furthermore, there's a terrible side to our history that's really not all that lovable. For instance, the extermination of American Native Indian nations, the enslavement of African people, the aggressive wars against Vietnam, Mexico, Canada. We lost 1,000 men on one attack on Canada, I just learned a little while ago. Central America, the Philippines, and elsewhere. Nor might we all be that enamored with certain aspects of American culture, certainly not the mind abuse of primetime television, the commercialism, the corporate greed, the ecological devastation, the economic and racial injustice. If I'm being asked to prove my patriotism by loving American popular culture, then I might fail the test, I guess. Well, the America that the super patriots claim to love is neither a geographical totality, nor is it a vast population, nor is it really a history or culture. As far as I can see, their America, and they say love America, is an ideological abstraction. It's an emotive symbol that can be embodied in other abstract symbols like the flag. It's a sort of almost a love without content. I mean, how else can you love a flag? I mean, a flag, as you know, is a piece of rag on a stick, and it's got colors and things. Well, having said that, let me contradict myself, because there is one real content to the super patriotism. Its main substance is militarism. The pacifist and political scientist and activist, by the way, good pacifists are all, not passive, they're pacifists, and they're quite active. The pacifist and activist, Milford Sibley, he once noted, quote, patriotism for most professional patriots seems to be inseparably connected with military violence and war. Indeed, the most militaristic among us seem to think that they are the most patriotic. Isn't that rather extraordinary? Patriotic virtues are equated with military ones. Our history's patriotic vignettes are usually military ones. Valley Forge, the Alamo, Gettysburg, the battleship Maine, Pearl Harbor, raising the flag on Iwo Jima, D-Day, the MIAs and POWs, and the like. Our country, right or wrong, but mostly our country at war or ready for war. The commemorations of our national leaders during national holidays would be incomplete without the marching troops, the weapon displays, martial music, formations of fighter planes zooming overhead. Even in local communities, when they organize patriotic celebrations, they usually appear the marching bands in semi-martial uniforms, the high school cadets with rifles on their shoulders, and if there's an army base nearby, even troops. I remember once sitting in Urbana, Illinois, standing there July 4th, watching this parade come by, and on this float was suddenly this missile, sort of small missile, but there was this instrument of death on this float that was going by. And there were some people around me, and you know what they did? They started to applaud this inanimate object. I mean, there wasn't even a pilot or, you know, somebody else tending to it, or a soldier striding it and waving and going, yow, look at me, you know. I mean, it was too much for me. They were just applauding this weapon. And then was a little jet fighter came by on the float, and they started applauding that too. This was at a time when these things were being used in Vietnam. Even July 4th fireworks are really a benign representation or replication of the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, as the top patriotic song on our patriotic hit parade goes. Max Weber once said that the state's irreducible characteristic is a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. And to be sure, state ceremonies in most states include some display of military force. Now, the way super patriots express their national pride leaves me uncomfortable. It seems the love we are to have for our country rests on some kind of competition with other countries, that it comes at an expense with other countries. It's a love that is predicated on some invidious comparison to other countries being lesser, being not as good. If we love our country, we have to believe it's better than any other. The super patriots will even ask us, don't you think this is the best country in the world? So that you love it because it's better. This, by the way, we might recognize immediately as the being number one syndrome. I guess I must have heard about being number one for a long time, but the first time it ever stuck in my mind was when I heard President Richard Nixon sometime in the late 60s announce, and I quote, America is still number one. The still, of course, you know, hints at some anxiety that there might be some slippage there. So I'm listening to this and I'm saying, okay, number one, that's, hey. But I was bothered by it because it presumed that we were in some kind of adversarial relationship to other nations, all other countries, and that somehow our greatness and our goodness could only be measured in comparison to them, only in our ability to be the top banana. And then one of those troublesome questions came again in my head, and I said, if we're number one, what are we number one in? I mean, what are you number one in? So I thought, I said, population? And then, no, the Chinese walk away with all the awards in that category. Geography? No, I think the Soviets and even Canada has more real estate than we do. We're not number one in size. I mean, Brazil, there's a number of countries, I think. I don't even want to think about it, about all the countries that might be ahead of us there. Steel production and other basic industries? I perked up a little. Well, we used to be number one in that, but we have slipped down the list because our super patriot corporate leaders have taken to abandoning our communities and exporting our jobs and bringing the factories off to Taiwan and Argentina and South Korea, where they can work for slave labor wages. Which, when you think about it, is not the way for super patriots to act, really, you know, take our factories away and all that.
I'm interrupting Michael Parenti for a moment to remind you that this contemporary-sounding talk was given in 1988. It became a TUC radio program and a book. Super Patriotism, How Hype, Fear, and Mindless Flag-Waving are Supplanting Informed Debate and Commitment to Democracy. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale.
I was sitting there saying, well, what are we number one in, you know? And the best I can tell from the super patriotic utterances is that it gets down to two things. One, wealth, with no concern as to how the wealth is distributed and how it's used and for what effects. And military power, with no concern, again, with how that military power is used and for whose interests that it might serve at home and abroad. Now, supposedly, we can love America and be proud of our country because it's so great. The implication is, however, that if it weren't so great, it wouldn't be so lovable. And that began to trouble me. The super patriot's love of country seems predicated on the country's being up there, stronger and superior to other countries. What happens if it's going to slip? What happens? I started thinking, what about people from lesser lands, as we might call them? I mean, what about somebody from Luxembourg? I mean, now Luxembourg is number 122, you know. I said, what does someone from Luxembourg do? Do they go around shamefaced like this, you know? They say, you from Luxembourg? You from Luxembourg? I said, No, I'm French. And you say, do you love your country? You know, they say, well, what is there to love? I mean, a few border police, no army, no navy. I mean, it's a... The super patriots were exhilarated by the U.S. aggression perpetrated against Grenada. To them, such military exploits are an affirmation of our nation's strength and worth, and therefore their own individual strength and worth. I mean, there are some people who went around who really got off on the invasion of Grenada. Ronald Reagan, the conqueror of Grenada, reflecting upon his greatest military victory, hailed the venture as an example of how the U.S. defends democracy. This preoccupation with being number one strikes me, ladies and gentlemen, as I say, as a sign of weakness, not of strength, as a sign of insecurity, not of security. A people who know who they are don't worry about being number one. A people who are in touch with the deeper values of social justice and democracy don't get a number one thrill from stomping on a tiny nation. A people who seek friendship and cooperation with other peoples don't need to lord it over other nations and outshine them. Such a people don't have to find reassurances in themselves by looking at or imagining the deficiencies of others. And they don't feel threatened by the accomplishments and strengths of other people. The state is no longer there to serve us. We are here to serve and glorify the state. The state becomes an entity, a force unto itself, a powerfully abstracted symbol that claims our ultimate and total loyalty, a moral object, a moral entity in itself, whose existence and growth are taken as self-justifying. You know, a question could be raised. What's so important about the state existing and growing and continuing and expanding and flourishing, whatever else? That's taken as self-justifying. In fact, that question would be considered unpatriotic. The moral code that applies to nationalism does not operate the same as the moral code that applies to individuals. The premise that governs all individual morality is that your behavior must at some point lead to self-restraint and even self-sacrifice. In individual morality, there are certain things you should not do, even if they're convenient, advantageous, and whatever else. Even if you have the impulse for them, even if they advance your self-interest, you must not do them. That's what the whole essence or code of individual morality is, as in thou shalt not. These premises are inverted when applied to a nation's behavior, and they often lead to terrible and untrammeled excesses. The nation-state is something more than human, and there lies the power of its appeal. At the heart of the super-patriotic ethic is the belief that the nation's existence and its actions are so endowed with virtue as to place it above the commonplace rules of life. The restraints that apply to ordinary humans don't restrain the nation. So, convinced of its supreme virtue, the nation knows no other restraint than the limitations of its own self-interest, its own desires, and the limitations of its own power. Ladies and gentlemen, the difference between individual morality and national morality is a very real one. When the aggrandizing individual commits an evil or harmful act, there's some sense that he is to be punished, he or she, or should be punished. At least some questions raised about whether proper standards of conduct haven't been violated. But some of the most outrageous acts, which would be outrageous under an individual moral code and unsupportable in civil life, are applauded as heroism when performed in the name of the nation. Thou shalt not becomes thou shalt do anything by any means necessary if it can be said to be in the national interest and if it serves national security. Well, who are the super patriots? They can be found in high and low places. They can be found in the White House, and they can be found in your local American Legion post. But super patriotism, I would argue, is not a product of mass psychology. It's not a product of mass macho psychology as such, although it certainly appeals to machismo, often resorting to a kind of John Wayne approach to foreign policy. The suppliers, the pushers of super-patriotism, most conspicuously are our top political leaders, our publicists, our media pundits, our institutional heads, including some college presidents and corporation leaders. Super-patriotic ideology is assiduously propagated by the ruling class of this society. But ideas do not float around in social space. You see, there's no such thing as just an idea around, like a virus. And so with ideas are mediated through social structure, through social organization, through a social system, that is through organized statuses, roles, groups, families, schools, communities, media, other institutions, whatever else. And some ideas then are mass marketed. Some ideas are taught to us from day one in those little flag salutes we have at school. One of the key functions of super patriotism is to blur the differences in class interests in our society and try to convince us that we're all in the same boat, rich and poor alike. You, me, the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rockefellers. In truth, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, on almost every issue, we the people are not in the same boat with the big financiers and companies. The costs of our policies are not equally shared. We pay the brunt of the costs. The benefits of our policies are not equally enjoyed. we don't get much of that. There's a case where you have to have a class analysis rather than a flag-waving analysis. This is equally true of ancient empires as well as modern empires. In 1919, the conservative economist Joseph Schumpeter, he described the imperialism of classical Rome in words that might sound familiar to present-day Americans. Quote, "That policy which pretends to aspire to peace but unerringly generates war, the policy of continual preparation for war, the policy of meddlesome interventionism." He's writing in 1919 about ancient Rome. "There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why, then it was the national honor that had been insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their indubitably aggressive designs. They were enemies who only waited to fall upon the Roman people." Now, in contrast to the super patriots, it begins to brighten here. Real patriots love their country enough to want to improve it, and their patriotism has a social content, and that social content is social justice. Real patriots do things the American way, the democratic way, not with secret crypto-fascist coteries in the national security state, but with open debate and open challenges against privileged interests. Real patriots know that democracy is not just the ability to hold elections, but to serve and fulfill the basic needs and interests of the demos, the people. Real patriots are also internationalists. They may love and feel attached to their country, but they also love the peoples of all countries, all being different representations of the human family. Real patriots find different things in our history to be proud of than the super patriots do. We're proud of things like the struggle for the enfranchisement, the abolitionist movement, the peace movement, the abolition of child labor, the struggle for collective bargaining, the extension of universal suffrage to people of color and to women, the struggle for racial justice, the 8-hour day, occupational safety, the struggle for gender equality. We need change. We need to tax the rich and not the poor. We need to restructure the use of energy to save the environment and ourselves. We need a health insurance program for the 35 million Americans who are not covered. I mean, isn't that amazing? Isn't it time for an investigation? How could that be? How did that come about? Why? We need people who not only bemoan these things, like the liberals say, isn't it a shame, the homeless? Isn't it a shame, not enough adequate health care? Isn't it a shame? You have to stop complaining about that. You have to start asking, but why does that exist? What are the forces that allow, in the richest country in the world, these kinds of terrible inhumanities and inequalities? The airwaves of this country, ladies and gentlemen, are the property of the people of the United States. That may come as a surprise to some network bosses, but it's true. And those airwaves should be opened up. There should be public access television. We need exposure to a socialist perspective. We need exposure to various dissident perspectives in the mainstream media. And we need discussion of worker-controlled enterprises and public ownership. We need a national debate in the mainstream media on the oppressive, unjust purposes of U.S. foreign policy in the Third World and elsewhere. We need to re-examine our institutions, our schools, our colleges, hospitals, museums. We've got to find out why all those institutions, our media, why they are all dominated by self-selected boards of trustees or regents who are answerable to no one but themselves and who control all spending, all hiring, and all other policies. We need a government that has the capacity to go directly into not-for-profit production. If private industry can't provide the needs of the people, if the utilities can't give you electricity without jacking up the rates every year, jacking it up again and again, then take it away from the utilities and the people themselves can do it themselves. If private industry can't build us homes and hospitals and get jobs, then let the public sector do it. There's all these people who need work. There's all this work that needs to be done. There's all this capital that can be used to do it. And none of it's come together because there's no profits in it for the Morgans and the Rockefellers and the DuPonts. So then let the public sector do it, not for profit, and it will get done. And when it gets done, it creates social income, it creates private income, it expands your tax base, it creates public income, and it creates more opportunities for growth. The danger with that, the danger is not that it won't work, the danger is that it does work. And that's why they stop it, that's why they want privatization, that's why they sell off Conrail at one-third its actual value, because Conrail under public ownership was working, and those railroads under private ownership were milked like cows, milked and run down, and then they turn around to the government, they turn around to the taxpayer, and then they go socialist after they've milked it down and it's about to fall apart, and they say, we can't run it anymore, you're going to have to take it over. And the taxpayers take it over, and they dig deeper into their pockets, and they pay for it, and they put it back on a working basis, a rational basis, a not-for-profit basis, so that the money it makes goes back into it and doesn't go out to the George Bushes and the Ronald Reagans and their class. And then when it works, Ronald Reagan says, we got to sell this thing. And he sells it not because it wasn't working, but because it does work. We need to open up our political system, ladies and gentlemen. We need to have new parties, not just two capitalist parties, not just two anti-communist parties. We need to have proportional representation so that if a minority party wins 11% of the vote, it gets 11% of the seats. We need funding for minority parties. We need free TV time for minority parties. We on the left are second to no one in our patriotism. We want fundamental restructuring and democratization of overseas and domestic policies. We want restructuring and democratization of the political process, the values, institutions, the economy, and the class power of this country. We real patriots say, along with Albert Camus, I want to love my country and justice too. And in fact, I believe that the only way you can be a real patriot is to love justice. Because you can't be patriotic to something that's unjust. We want to spend less time trying to save the world with bombers and battleships and more time healing ourselves. This is not just a good idea or a noble pronouncement. It is a historical necessity. This country does not belong to Ronald Reagan and his billionaire friends, although they act like it does. It belongs to us, and sooner or later, we will take it back. Thank you.
You heard excerpts from a talk on super patriotism by the internationally known writer and lecturer Michael Parenti. He is one of this country's foremost political analysts and the author of over 20 books. This timeless archival talk was recorded by KGNU Radio. And the presidency of Donald Trump brought back the memory of this 1988 TUC radio program and of the book published by City Lights in 2004, Michael Parenti, Super Patriotism, How Hype, Fear, and Mindless Flag Waving are Supplanting Informed Debate and Commitment to Democracy. If this sounds important today, please pass on this free speech. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.